Hi, this is Pastor Matt, and I want to welcome you to our Blue Oaks Church podcast. At the end of this episode, feel free to download our Blue Oaks Church app, where you'll be able to access resources, events, and ways to get connected at Blue Oaks and in the community. The app is the easiest way to share this content with a friend, and it's the easiest way to keep up with everything going on around Blue Oaks. Most importantly, though, I just hope that you enjoy this episode and it inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey.
Well, good morning. There's some things that like are just like so habitual for me when I walk out here. There's like a dot on the stage. It's like a yellow dot. It's like, this is where you're supposed to stand, and it's not there. So I feel like so nervous right now. Like I don't know where to be. So here I am. Well, good morning. If we haven't met, I'm Matt. I'm one of the pastors here at Blue Oaks. And if you're new, we have been making our way through the book of Romans. And over the last several weeks, we've been walking through Romans 9, 10, and 11. And if you've been here, you know these chapters have taken us into some deep waters. We've wrestled with questions like, can God be trusted when his plans don't make sense? What do you do when people you love are far from God? How do you make sense of God's purposes when life doesn't unfold the way you expected? These aren't abstract theological questions. Like, these are the kinds of questions that show up in hospital rooms. They show up in strained relationships. They show up when you've been praying for something for years and nothing seems to be changing. They show up when you're looking at your life and you're wondering exactly what God is doing. So for three chapters, Paul has been wrestling with those kinds of questions. And what's interesting is that as Romans 11 comes to a close, Paul never gets to a place where he explains everything. He doesn't suddenly solve every mystery. He doesn't answer every question. Instead, I think he does something more meaningful. He steps back and he realizes what God is doing is bigger than anyone could have imagined. Have you ever had one of those moments where you suddenly realize just how small your perspective is? Like, maybe you've experienced it while traveling. You spend hours driving through a mountain range and then you reach a lookout point and you can finally see like the entire valley. Suddenly everything looks different. Or maybe you've flown somewhere and looked out the airplane window after takeoff and the streets that seemed so important just a couple hours earlier now look tiny. Like the traffic that was so overwhelming just disappears. The problems that seemed enormous begin looking much smaller from 30,000 feet. Nothing has changed. The situation is exactly the same. What changed is your perspective. You can finally see something bigger than what is just right in front of you. I think that's what Paul is doing here. Like for three chapters, he's been wrestling with Israel's story. He's been wrestling with God's promises. He's been wrestling with questions about faith and rejection and mercy and salvation. And then suddenly he just steps back. And when he does, he sees something bigger than questions. He sees God. And the result is worship. In fact, before we read today's passage, I want you to know where Paul is headed. And so near the end of Romans 11, these are the words that he writes. Oh, the depth of the riches of wisdom and knowledge of God, like how unsearchable his judgments and his path beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay them? For from him and through him and for him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. That's where we're going today. Those words are not the conclusion of an argument. They're the response of someone who suddenly realizes how big God is. All right, so let's begin at verse 25. So Paul begins this section by saying, I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers and sisters, so that you may not be conceited. Israel has experienced the hardening in part until the full number of the Gentiles has come in. And in this way, all Israel will be saved. And I want you to notice the word mystery. When we hear the word mystery, we tend to think of something mysterious or something spooky or something impossible to understand. But that's not what Paul means. In the New Testament, a mystery is something that God is doing that people weren't able to figure out on their own. I mean, think about Peter in Acts 10, if you know that story. Peter never imagined that God would welcome Gentiles into his family without actually first becoming Jewish. And so it took a vision from God before he could even see it, before he could even imagine it. And that's what Paul means here by mystery. God was revealing something that no one could see coming. And to appreciate how surprising this was, we have to remember that the first century Jewish people thought completely different about God's future. Like, most Jewish people believed that when the Messiah came, he would restore Israel. Israel would be vindicated, Israel's enemies would be defeated, and all nations would recognize Israel's God. What almost no one expected was that God would create one family made up of both Jews and Gentiles through faith in Jesus. For us, that's normal. Like, we've grown up in churches full of people from different ethnicities and different backgrounds, but Paul's audience did not. This was revolutionary. Imagine a lifelong Giants fan discovering that the Dodgers were not the opposition anymore. Like, they were suddenly part of the family. Okay, never mind. Don't imagine that. Like, some of you are doing fine until I brought up the Dodgers. Maybe that kind of like pushes the limits of Christian unity. I know we have some Dodger fans here, and you can gloat about your record and all that, but we don't care. Seriously, though, this is the kind of thing that was just shocking. Like, Paul is saying that God's plan was always about something bigger than one nation. It was always about creating one people through his mercy. And when Paul looks back on it, he realizes no one could have seen this coming. Not because it was irrational, but because it was so much bigger than anyone would have expected. And that's often how God works. Like, very few people can see what God is doing while he's doing it. Most of us only recognize his faithfulness when we are looking backward. Have you ever had an experience where something felt so disappointing in the moment, only to realize later that God was doing something better than you could have ever seen? Like, that's the kind of perspective that Paul is talking about. Israel's rejection of Jesus was not the end of the story. God used it to bring the gospel to the Gentiles. And then God would use the inclusion of the Gentiles as part of his ongoing work with Israel. That's why Paul goes on to say, in this way, all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will turn godlessness away from Jacob. And this is my covenant with them. When I take away their sins. As for the gospel is concerned, they are enemies for your sake, but as far as election is concerned, they are loved on account of the patriarchs, for God's gifts and his call are irrevocable. Now, these verses have generated a lot of discussion over the years, especially the phrase, all Israel will be saved, and Christians have debated it. Like, what does Paul actually mean here? Does he mean every Jewish person who has ever lived? Does he mean a future turning of all the Jewish people toward Jesus? And I just tell you, Christians who love Jesus and who take scripture very seriously come to very different conclusions about the details. But I think Paul's main point is actually very clear. God is not done. God is not finished with Israel. And maybe someone here needs to hear that, because you're tempted to believe that God is finished with you, that God is finished with your marriage, that God is finished with your family, that God is finished with your future, that God is finished with your son or daughter that you've been praying for. One of the things Romans 11 teaches us is that God is often still working in places where we assume the story is over. The same God who made promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob has not forgotten his promises. And Paul wants these Gentile believers in Rome to understand Israel's current unbelief is not the end of the story. God's faithfulness is bigger than their failure. In fact, notice what Paul says in verse 29, for God's gifts and his call are irrevocable. It's one of the most important statements in the entire chapter. And before anyone misunderstands me, it isn't a promise that like every plan that we make will succeed. But it is a reminder that God's faithfulness is not fragile. He doesn't abandon people the first time they fail. And that's good news because every person in this room has given God reasons to walk away, and yet he hasn't. Irrevocable means God doesn't change his mind. Like he doesn't take back his promises. He doesn't wake up one day and decide that he's done with his people. You know, the entire story of Scripture is filled with people who fail. Abraham fails, Moses fails, David fails, Peter fails, the disciples all fail. And yet over and over and over again, God remains faithful. And that's Paul's point. The story continues because God is faithful to his promises. In other words, while everyone thought the story was falling apart, it's not true. God was still writing the story. This is a kind of a theme that we've seen over and over again throughout Romans 9, 10, and 11. People thought God's promises had failed. Paul says they hadn't. People thought God had rejected Israel. Paul says he hadn't. People thought they understood exactly what God was doing. Paul says the story was so much bigger than anyone realized. I've been thinking about that a lot this year. There have been moments over the last couple of years where I've looked at my life and honestly thought, I would never have written this chapter. Like some things I hoped would never happen, happened. Some things I never wanted to happen, happened. Some things I hoped wouldn't happen, they did happen. I remember waking up some mornings and just realizing I have no idea what God is doing. You know, it didn't stop me from believing in him. It was that I couldn't imagine why this chapter belonged in my story. Like I would have done anything to edit it out. I would have done anything to skip ahead. I would have done anything to have written it differently if it was possible. But one of the gifts of getting older is realizing that some of the chapters I least wanted to live eventually become some of the chapters where I saw God's faithfulness most clearly. And by the way, I just want to say how grateful I am for Steve's teaching last week. One of the things I appreciated was his reminder that hope is a vision of a future good that shapes how we live now. And I've been thinking about that all week. And that's exactly what Paul is trying to do here. He's trying to help us to trust God's future faithfulness, even though we don't fully understand his current activity. One of the gifts of getting older is realizing how many times God has already been faithful in chapters I did not understand at the time. And when I look back, I get to see his fingerprints all over the place where I completely missed it when I was living it. And I still don't understand everything, but I've seen enough of God's faithfulness to trust that he's going to continue to be faithful in the parts that I don't understand. I think one of the reasons this is difficult for us is because we live in a culture that values, probably above everything, understanding. Like we love solving problems, we love figuring things out, we love having answers. Like this is the Bay Area. Like if something doesn't make sense, our instinct is to gather more information until it does. Like there's probably an app for that. Like there's definitely a startup working on it. Like if something breaks, someone starts a podcast, writes a book, and creates a YouTube channel explaining how to solve it. And it's not all bad. Like human creativity is a gift. Learning is a gift. Discovery is all a gift. But eventually, everyone runs into situations they cannot solve by more information. And questions that cannot be answered with a spreadsheet, and circumstances that cannot be controlled, and moments when we're forced to admit that we just can't see everything. That's exactly where Paul finds himself. He's looking at God's work across generations, across nations, across centuries, and he's realizing God is doing something like no one could have fully seen when they were living it. That's why Paul spends verses 30 and 31 talking about mercy. Just as you who were at one time disobedient to God have now received mercy as a result of their disobedience, so they too have now become disobedient in order that they too may receive mercy as a result of God's mercy to you. Notice how often this word mercy appears. And notice what Paul is describing. The Gentiles were disobedient and then they received mercy. Israel is experiencing disobedience, and Paul believes that mercy is a part of their story as well. In other words, no one in this story gets to look at themselves and say, well, of course God chose us. Like, of course God is working through us. Of course we understand what he's doing. Like, every group in the story has moments of faithlessness and moments of faithfulness, moments of failure and moments of mercy. Every group becomes this recipient of God's mercy. It's almost as if Paul wants us to stop looking at the people in the story and start looking at the God who keeps showing mercy throughout the story. Because the hero of Romans 11 isn't Israel. The hero isn't Gentiles. It's God. And that prepares us for the conclusion he reaches in verse 32. For God has bound everyone over to disobedience so that he may have mercy on them all. And I know that we need to like address this phrase because that sounds weird. Like, God has bound everyone over to disobedience. Paul isn't saying that God caused people to sin. He's saying that God has allowed human beings to experience the consequences of their own choices. Like, throughout Romans, we see people resist God, we see people reject God, we see people insist on their own way. And at various points, God allows them to experience where that path leads. Why? Because God is trying to show something. That no one can save themselves. That no one can fix themselves. That no one can earn their way back to God. Eventually, every one of us discovers that we have a desperate need for God's mercy. That's where Paul has taken us. And what strikes me is how completely this levels the playing field. Like, for three chapters, we've been like tempted to ask, you know, who's right, who's wrong, who's in, who's out, who's responding correctly, who's missing what God is doing. But Paul's answer is surprising. Everyone needs mercy. The religious need mercy. The irreligious need mercy. The people who see clearly need mercy. The people who are confused need mercy. The people who have been following God for decades need mercy. The person who walked in here today unsure about what they believe needs mercy. No one gets to stand above anyone else. And that would have been especially challenging in the ancient world because honor was everything. Your status mattered, your family mattered, your ethnicity mattered. Like, people spent their lives trying to establish where they ranked in society, which when you think about it, hasn't changed much in 2000 years. Paul's point is that mercy destroys every reason for boasting. No one gets to say, I earned my place. No one gets to say, I deserve this more than someone else. Mercy has a way of making all of us grateful instead of proud. And I think that's the point. After all the debates, after all the questions, the disagreements, Paul wants us to remember that no one stands before God as experts. We all stand before God as recipients. People who have received something that we could never give ourselves. People who have been shown mercy. Now, this is not a category most of us naturally like. We would much rather be achievers rather than recipients. But Paul says the foundation of a relationship with God is not that you have accomplished anything. It's the mercy that we've received. And the deeper Paul goes into God's plan, the more he realizes that like his mercy is at the center of everything. And I wonder if that's part of why this just kind of leaves him so overwhelmed. Because when he steps back and he looks at the story, he realizes God has been far more merciful than anyone imagined. Like, not just to Israel, not just to the Gentiles, not to, like, it's to everyone, including him, including you and me. In fact, I think this is where Paul begins running out of words. For three chapters, he's been explaining. Now you can almost feel him just kind of reaching the limits of explanation. Because eventually there comes a point where the right response to God's mercy is no longer analysis. It's worship. And that's exactly where Paul goes next. Listen again to what he says. Oh, the depths of the riches of wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Like, who was ever given to God that God should repay them? I love the way Paul begins. Oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. That first word tells everything. Oh. That isn't the language of a professor giving a lecture. This isn't the language of someone who just won an argument. Like, this is the language of someone who is standing in awe. It's almost as if Paul reaches the edge of what he can explain and suddenly realizes that God is so much bigger than he thought. And I don't know about you, but I find that so encouraging. Because Christians have wrestled with questions in Romans 9 through 11 for centuries. Questions about God's sovereignty, questions about human responsibility, questions about election, questions about mercy, questions about why some people leave and others don't. Paul affirms realities that sometimes feel so difficult to hold together. Like, God is sovereign, and human beings are genuinely responsible for their response to him. Like, Paul clearly teaches both of those things. And I think there's something incredibly important about that, because whenever we come to Romans 9, 10, and 11, there's this temptation to, like, demand a level of precision that Paul never provides. Like, we want diagrams, and we want systems, and we want flowcharts, and we want to know exactly how everything fits together. Like, some of us research a vacation longer than we actually take the vacation. And now we're trying to map out the mind of God. We want to know exactly how God's sovereignty and human responsibility fit together. Well, Paul teaches both. And after three chapters, he doesn't give us a chart. He gives us a doxology, which tells me we don't have to understand everything in order to trust God. We don't. Paul understood enough to worship, enough that, though he couldn't explain every mystery, but he understood enough. There are realities that we can understand truly without understanding exhaustively. There are realities that we can understand truly without understanding exhaustively. We live with this reality every day. Like, most of us have no idea how electricity actually works. Like, we just flip the switch and it comes on. Most of us couldn't explain how GPS works, yet we trust it enough to drive somewhere that we have never been. Most of us couldn't explain how the internet works. And yet somehow we are comfortable storing our entire lives on it. Like, we understand enough to trust it, not enough to fully explain it. And Paul is saying something similar about God. Not that God is like electricity or GPS or the internet, but that there are realities that can be trusted long before they're fully understood. The goal of Romans 9 through 11 is not that we walk away saying, well, now I've figured God out. The goal is that we walk away saying, God is bigger than I realized. What he never does is fully explain how these realities fit together. Instead, he ends by worshiping the God whose wisdom is greater than ours. Not because he understands everything, but because he understands enough. He understands enough to know that God is wiser than he is. He understands enough to know that God is faithful. He understands enough to know that God's purposes are way bigger than his perspective. And that's very different from the way many people think about faith. Like, some people assume faith begins when all of the questions disappear. But that's not what we see here. Faith isn't the absence of questions. Faith is learning to trust the character of God even when those questions remain. Which is why Paul says how unsearchable his judgments and his path beyond tracing out. And maybe that's more relevant than we realize. Because most of us are carrying something right now that we don't understand. Like a decision, a relationship, a disappointment, a prayer, something we wish God would explain. And when he doesn't give us the explanation, our instinct is often to assume God is not working. We assume silence means absence. We assume confusion means God has forgotten us. We assume unanswered questions means God isn't paying attention. Well, Paul would actually say the opposite. The fact that you don't understand what God is doing doesn't mean that God is absent. It may simply mean you're not seeing the whole picture yet. And this matters because the size of your God will shape the way you live. Like if God is small, every unanswered question will become a crisis. Every disappointment will become a threat. Every setback will become a reason for you to panic. Because ultimately, everything will depend on you. However, if God is as wise as Paul says he is, if God is as faithful as Paul says he is, if God is as merciful as Paul says he is, then you'll just live differently. You can take a step forward even though you don't have every answer. You can remain faithful even when circumstances are confusing. You can trust him with people you love. You can trust him with situations that you can't control. And it's not because you understand everything, but because you know the one who does understand everything. And then Paul arrives at his final conclusion. It's one verse, but it may be the most beautiful verse in the entire Bible. For from him and through him and for him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. I don't know if you've noticed this, but almost every conflict in life eventually comes down to one question. Who is the story about? Like most of us spend our entire lives assuming we're somewhere near the center. Like my goals, my plans, my success, my disappointments, my timeline, my future, my happiness. And that's all understandable. Like we experience life from our own perspective. We carry our own burdens. We feel our own disappointments. We naturally see ourselves at the center of the story. It's worth remembering that Paul is writing to a people living in Rome, and Rome was obsessed with glory. Like people wanted their names to be remembered. They wanted monuments and titles and recognition and status and honor. Entire careers were spent pursuing glory, their glory. In many ways, things haven't changed much for us. Like we may not build marble statues anymore, but we still chase recognition. We still want significance. We want people to notice. We want our lives to matter, which makes Paul's final words so striking. After everything he said, he doesn't direct the glory to himself. He doesn't direct it toward Israel. He doesn't direct it toward the church. He directs it toward God. To him be the glory forever. For from him, this is great, for from him, everything begins with him, creation begins with him, life begins with him, grace begins with him, salvation begins with him. Every good thing ultimately finds its source in him and through him. Meaning he isn't just the starting point, he's the sustaining power. He's every breath, every heartbeat, every moment of grace, every act of redemption, every part of history. God isn't absent from the story. He's actively carrying the story forward and for him. And that's the part our culture struggles with the most, because we're taught that life is ultimately about self-fulfillment, finding ourselves, expressing ourselves, building our lives around ourselves. Paul says something entirely different. Life ultimately will find its meaning in God. The story begins with him, the story is sustained by him, and the story ultimately leads back to him. Which means even when I don't understand everything God is doing, I can trust that he's taking this story somewhere good, because the story belongs to him. And I think that's what Paul has discovered throughout Romans 9, 10, and 11. He started with questions, really difficult questions, really painful questions, questions about people he loved, questions about God's promises, questions about things he couldn't fully understand. But by the end, something has completely changed. The questions haven't all disappeared, but Paul has become overwhelmed by the greatness of God. And maybe that's the invitation for us today, to trust the God whose wisdom is deeper than our wisdom, to trust the God whose mercy is greater than our mercy, to trust the God whose faithfulness extends so far, it's so much farther than we can see, the God from whom and through whom and for whom are all things. I know there are people here who are sitting in the middle of very different stories. Some of you are maybe waiting on test results. Some of you are praying for a son or a daughter. Some of you are wondering if your marriage will ever heal. Some of you thought this stage of your life would look totally different. Like, we all have our version of Romans 11. A couple of weeks ago, I was watching the Netherlands play Morocco in the World Cup, and Cody Gakpo scored a goal, and instead of celebrating, he immediately broke down. I didn't really know what was happening. You can tell it just wasn't a normal experience or emotion for him. He was sobbing on the field, and the announcers explained that he and his wife had recently lost their unborn son, and they had already named him Elijah. And as I watched him standing there on the field in the middle of the biggest tournament in the world, completely overcome by his grief, I thought about how little we actually know about what people are carrying. And then later I looked up the story and I found out there's another part of the story. After their loss, Gakpo's wife shared that they visited a church, and while they were there, they met a little boy named Elijah. And she described it as just like one of those moments where she sensed that God's kindness met her in the middle of her pain. And I think that's where many of us live. Like, we want explanations. Like, we want God to tell us why. Like, why did the relationship end? Why did the diagnosis come? Why did the prayer go unanswered? Why did everything unfold the way that it did? And sometimes God will give explanations, but often what he gives us is something deeper. Often he just gives us his presence, and he reminds us that he's still working, and he reminds us that he's still faithful. And eventually there comes a moment when we realize God is bigger than our questions. Not because the questions stop mattering, but because we begin to see the greatness of the one who's holding the story. And maybe that's the real turning point. Because when God is small, like, every question we have becomes so enormous. Like, every disappointment feels final. Every unanswered prayer feels so overwhelming. But when God becomes so much bigger, the questions don't necessarily disappear. The disappointment doesn't instantly go away. The grief remains. What changes is our confidence in the one who's holding the story. The way we live is deeply connected to the size of our God. And Paul has spent three chapters helping us to see a God who is bigger than understanding. He's bigger than our failures. He's bigger than our fears. He's bigger than our questions. And where Paul arrives after three chapters of wrestling and three chapters of questioning and three chapters of trying to understand what God is doing, he stops explaining. He just starts worshiping. Oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable his judgments and its paths beyond tracing out. Who can know the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay them? For from him and through him and for him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. And maybe that's where we need to be today. Like, not every question is answered, but just like with this deeper confidence in the God who holds the story, the God from whom and through whom and for whom are all things. So I'm going to ask you to just stand with me. And, you know, I feel like in this passage, Paul takes us as far as words can take us, and then he just worships. And so I'm going to ask you to join us in worshiping our God.
Hey, once again, thanks for listening. We hope you found something in this week's message to take away and apply to your life this week. If you live in the Bay Area, we would love to have you join us for one of our weekend services. For directions or information about what we have for you or your family, your students, you can go to blueoaks.church or download the app today. And we hope to see you on Sunday soon.